Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How do people survive in Sudan? The country has been embroiled in civil conflict for most of the last half century, leaving a population deeply scarred by poverty, violence, and disease. Those challenges did not deter my guest today from accepting a six-month posting with the international aid group Doctors Without Borders. In fact, he had specialized in emergency medicine in school, a field that would allow him to leave his hospital job in Toronto for long periods of time without leaving regular patients in the lurch. So he packed what he thought he would need, studied up on equatorial diseases he had seen only in textbooks, and set out for the small village that would forever change the way he saw the world. Dr. James Miskolic is assistant professor of medicine at the University of Toronto and a founding editor of the journal Open Medicine. His new book is called 6 Months in Sudan, A Young Doctor in a War-Torn Village. James, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
You write something really interesting in trying to explain this to those of us who do not have a similar experience about the way your perception of where it all started continued to shift. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I think that, you know, we perhaps out of convenience like to organize things into beginnings and endings. But of course, there's no real, you know, often no real beginning and end. And for me, as I thought back about how this story started, the one I was going to try to tell in my book, as I, you know, it wasn't as simple as when I stepped on the ground in Sudan. It's something I'd been preparing for quite a long time, and I describe it as kind of the soft bookends of what was, the, you know, the final destination of Sudan. And I think that, you know, what when it really started, when I thought about it, when I knew I'd have to, when I was trying to explain it to myself, was when I finally put my bags down in the compound in Abyei, Sudan, for the first time. That's when that was the starter pistol. That was the time go. But before that, it was many months and many years of careful preparation to kind of put me into the middle of that place.
And yet, despite all that preparation, and you were not someone who went into this naively, having no idea what you were getting into, but you can still never be quite ready for what you're going to see.
Yeah, I think that, you know, it's one of those aphorisms that it's repeated so often because it's true. Be careful what you wish for, because you just might get it. And I was hoping for something that was, you know, as remote and as close to as conflict and as poverty as I could get, just so I could better understand that type of medicine and better understand that world. And it's something that, you're right, as you anticipate it in your mind, you can't really even properly place. You can't properly place yourself in the middle of the action until you're actually there. Try as you might, you imagine it in many different ways and you think about it, but only once you find yourself there do you really realize what it is that you're doing.
Tell us a little bit, James, about what's known in English as Doctors Without Borders, but is often identified by its French initials, MSF. What are its goals and resources?
Well, Médecins Sans Frontières was started in the 70s by a group of doctors and journalists. And, you know, from that time, it's those two very important principles of what MSF does, and that's, you know, offer assistance to populations in distress, but also tell the story. And, you know, in the genesis of MSF, it's a medical humanitarian organization. At the beginning, they were doctors and journalists working in Nigeria, and it became clear that the etiology of the famine that they were seeing a lot of was not only meteorologic, but it was political. And they said, they thought that if there was anyone who had access to that information, it was them, and with it went a responsibility to tell the story and hope for perhaps some type of resolution. So MSF works in, you know, dozens of countries, sends thousands of volunteers away every year to work in its mostly emergency relief operations. And proudly, I think, or at least I'm proud, is that 90% of people who work for MSF are national staff. So when I was in Sudan, most of the people who I was working with were Sudanese, which, as you can imagine, is one of the great merits of doing this kind of work, is trying to work yourself out of a job. So MSF, I think, of the armada of medical NGOs has been, over years, developed a very tried and true way of approaching the medicine of, you know, of poverty and of conflict, and I look forward to working with them again.
Yeah, you explain in the book why you chose MSF over other medical aid organizations, and the best answer boils down to an emergency shelter that your colleagues built in a single day.
Yeah, I was we were facing a measles epidemic when I first arrived. There was, you know, the doctor who was leaving said, "You should watch. There's been some news of measles in the surrounding area." And then, sure enough, a day later, I saw a case of measles, and the day after that, two, and then five, and then 15, and it was clear there was an epidemic. And so we were going to screen as we decided we need to immunize the surrounding countryside. We thought there was 20,000 children we needed to immunize. We're going to screen them all for malnutrition as well, too, because, you know, the two kind of go hand in hand. And I was wondering aloud one morning meeting about what we were going to do, because if we're looking in the countryside for malnourished kids, there's for sure going to exceed the capacity that we had in the hospital. And everyone nodded and agreed, and we decided the next best what we were going to do after lunch was go and buy the necessary tools, and 2 hours later we were making a shelter in the back of the hospital for the infected patients and the malnourished kids, and it really happened later that day. And so it was, you know, before you knew it, hammers and nails, and I think that was a great reminder about the capacity.
In a part of the world where for months out of the year no one has quite enough to eat, what are you looking for in terms of malnutrition that tells you that a child in particular is critically threatened?
Well, it's a tough decision, because as you point out, in places like that, most of the population is malnourished. And, you know, as I learn more about the condition, you realize, you know, when you get what would be, an epidemic of malnutrition, or you're seeing more people who are malnourished, the whole population has gotten worse, not just those, you know, not just from 5% of kids out of 10, but the whole population has become more malnourished. And so, unfortunately, we do make a distinction to treat only the moderate and severely malnourished kids. So you can see a very easy measure is arm circumference. So there's a tape that we use, and you cinch it around a child's arm, and or an adult, so it's adult size as well too. And if it's less than a certain diameter, that tells you it's mostly just bone. There's not a lot of soft tissue, not a lot of fat or muscle, and that's a very crude screening tool. And once you have a chance to weigh a child, you can plot their weight and their height, and you can get an idea of how much they should weigh for how tall they are. And if they're less than that, then they're just moderately or severely malnourished. You can see other signs of, you know, the hair is very, it turns red sometimes, or brittle and breaks and things like that, but you get used to it over time.
Yeah, I wonder, I guess the thing that you sort of have to find yourself getting used to is if not turning people away, rationing the resources that you have to treat people who in any Western facility would rise right to the top of the triage list.
Yeah, for sure. You know, you know, I work in a couple hours here in Toronto at a downtown hospital, and a lot of your time is spent sifting through to get to acute pathology, people who are in danger or in an emergency crisis. And, in Sudan, it wasn't really that problem. Everyone needed help, more or less, you know, like needed urgent attention. And, you know, when I see someone, if I see someone later today who's sick or injured, I can say with, you know, utmost sincerity to their family, where I can offer you the best medicine in the world. And when you're working in a place like rural Sudan, you can say, well, we can do the best we can. And sometimes when it's not enough, you can feel, or as a physician, that I didn't live up to my end of the bargain. And that can wear you down a little bit.
Yeah, I wonder how you sort of went to bed at night knowing you had absolutely done the best you could, but that you didn't have the tools necessary to provide care.
Yeah, I think I didn't sleep very well, that's for sure, because, you know, the question is, did you do enough? You know, is there more you could have done? Could you be there right now? Are you sure that kid is getting, you know, the correct doses of water or oral rehydration solution? But at some point, you know, you've got to leave the hospital to go home and feed yourself, even if it means that, you know, it's going to potentially at the cost of a patient's welfare. So you're right. You know, I'd go to bed, as we all would, wondering wondering whether we could do more, what we would do tomorrow, what tomorrow would bring. And it's something that when the needs so outweigh your resources, it becomes that. That's a constant theme.
How did your thoughts on aid to developing countries change while you were in Sudan?
Well, I think that, you know, I've been doing this off and on for 10 years or so. So I guess it's changed throughout that time more than it did throughout Sudan. I think that, you know, I had an early experience when I went to Cambodia. I worked in a rural area there. I did a needs assessment and decided I wanted to collate as much as I could the information that was available to, you know, so I wouldn't have to duplicate it for reasons of efficiency. I went to a library in Phnom Penh, an NGO library that had all of these reports, and I looked at this one shelf, and it was primary health care, and there were dozens and dozens and dozens of versions of different people's opinions from different countries about how the Cambodians should address their own health. And I thought, wow, you know, some of them were, you know, only petered out after a few years, and some of them, you know, were a bit more thoughtful and measured. But I thought, you know, well, that's, you know, that could be my fate. You know, now I have the privilege, as the one with the resources, it's my privilege to waste them. And so, you know, I learned a good lesson. I met with someone in the Ministry of Health and said, you know, I'm here with the working and with the University of Toronto. We have these resources. How do you want me to direct them? And I think that you're seeing that, hopefully, that question asked more and more. There's a woman named Demby Samoyo who wrote a book called Dead Aid that's getting a lot of attention now because she says essentially, which may be close to the truth in some ways, that the distribution of aid from government to government is a policy failure, that it has not solved the problems of poverty. And in fact, her thesis is that it has perpetuated it in some cases. So I think what ideally, you know, MSF, I think, is a bit of a different animal because we work mostly in emergency relief. But when you're looking at development and aid, I think that the transition of that as much as possible to local hands is likely the best, and to properly measure the outcomes of where the resources are intended and whether they're actually achieving the results that we all hope that they do.
Can you give us a quick description of the field hospital in Abyei that you were working at?
Yeah, it was, I remember my first morning when I woke up to a knock on the door of my hut. I was asked to go to the hospital, and I rushed, because there was a car accident, I rushed there and down this hospital road to see the front gate for the very first time. It was packed full of people. I had to push my way through. I didn't know where anything was. I didn't know where my team was. I didn't know where my patients were. I couldn't speak the same language, and it seemed so huge. And, of course, with time, it shrank. And it was a series, it was a hospital, it was probably built in the 70s or so, and, you know, six or seven hospital wards, a small operating theater at the back, and two rooms where we kept contagious tuberculosis patients, a small nursing room, a tiny emergency room that was, you know, about as big as a bathroom, and room enough for one bed. And patients scattered on the floors of the hospital. Most people didn't prefer not to stay in rooms. It was too hot. By the end of the time, after we built the huts because of the measles patients, there was a series of wooden huts we had made throughout the periphery of the compound with grass roofs because it was much cooler.
Let me stop you there and I'll have you finish that description in just a moment. We need to take a quick break. My guest is Dr. James Miskolic. His new book is called 6 Months in Sudan, A Young Doctor in a War-Torn Village. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call us now at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Dr. James Miskolic, whose new book is called 6 Months in Sudan, A Young Doctor in a War-Torn Village. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can send an email to think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. So you were talking, James, about the fact that, you had built out these additional huts outside the hospital building itself.
Yeah, and around the periphery of the hospital was a cement wall, and when we arrived to Abyei, it was about 6 months before I got there was when the mission started. One of those walls was broken down because attached to the hospital was a military compound, and with one of the two armies, their soldiers were barracked there, and before we arrived, we're using the hospital freely, wandering in and out, using the latrines. And I'm sure as it was convenient for them, it was always also a particularly good strategic move to claim, you know, the most valuable resource in that little town for themselves. And so we arrived and said, you know, we will move into the hospital and give free medical care and free medicines, but we're going to put up a barricade in that broken part of the wall, and you're welcome to come in anytime, day or night, but you have to go around front like everyone else. And the only rule is no guns. And so, effectively, of all the goodness I think that, you know, has happened in that hospital, I think that was the single greatest act, because you've returned that place, maybe the only place in that whole area, to the people that wasn't, you know, partisan, that was a place for peace.
How did your relationship to fear change when, in a very dangerous place to you personally, you had more reason to fear for all the people that you were charged with caring for?
I think that, you know, I never, maybe naively, I never felt particularly, you know, no one pointed a gun at me in anger. Although there was some gunfire in the hospital, it was never directed at us. So, you know, you go through this process of immersion where when you arrive, you're like, wow, it's all soldiers and there's a lot of guns. And then after 2 or 3 weeks, you don't see it. You know, that danger, maybe your danger level creeps up to accommodate the increased risk. But what has happened, at least for, you know, I think my attention to my own health in the face of so much sickness and disease and death, I think that the preciousness of it fades a little bit. When, you know, I was working in a TB project, it was one of the greatest pleasures for me was to help get this TB program up off the ground, and I really valued it as a physician because my patients got better when I saw other people in other parts of the hospital. Many times they didn't. So at first I would wear a mask, and because, you know, obviously you don't want to get contagious TB. And then I stopped. I thought, you know, well, I'm probably not going to get it, but I also wanted to show some solidarity to the patients who had TB. I didn't want to have that barrier between them and me. But also, with time, I think that, you know, if by all accounts the plane is going down, smoke them if you got them kind of scenario.
And in fact, you sort of took up smoking again right at the time that you got there.
Right. Similar reasons perhaps. And also, there's very few things to mark the hours. There's not a lot of contours to your days. So, you know, as has been said in many languages, when you have a cigarette, you have a friend. And so I think a lot of it's really common in MSF missions, particularly if you're isolated, for that to be a currency, you know, between colleagues as well as between even, you know, if you don't speak the language to someone, it's can become of a social habit as well, too.
And we should say you were mildly sick a lot, based in large part on the food and the sort of sanitation that was available.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was sick every, you know, couple weeks, which is really not... You know, I think it was one of the hardest things. It's something that I kind of forget now. That, but during the time, it was a struggle to, especially when you're not able to have a lot of resources, you know, emotionally or spiritually, to physically have be depleted as well too was kind of difficult. You know, I think as the mission went on, as we learned more. We grew to become a little bit more established. So too, things changed. I think the food changed somewhat and the water and things like that. So by the time when I was leaving and there were other new members of the team, they'd never really seen it back in the old days, you know, 3 or 4 months ago, what it was like. And, yeah, so I think that, like all things, hopefully it trended towards better days.
And you write about the preciousness of this little jar of Nutella, which is that hazelnut kind of chocolate stuff that people put on toast sometimes. And it was hidden in the back of the freezer.
For sure. Yeah, I know. That's very precious stuff. Whenever you get a package from home, you secretly hope that someone can find room to smuggle some of that in there. Yeah, that's right. It's a bit of currency for those people who work in isolated places.
Let's talk for a minute about measles, because this was the overwhelming crisis that you were dealing with, especially in the early days of your stay there. For people who don't really remember what an epidemic is like, can you talk about why it's so dangerous and how it absolutely sort of rips through populations where people haven't had enough to eat?
Well, one thing you learn when doing this type of medicine, if you have a group of refugees, 20,000 refugees who are starving and have no food, before you give them either of those things, the first thing you do is immunize them against measles. Because if you don't, then you have 20,000 people who are starving and with not enough water who are now infected with measles. Hmm. It's a very contagious disease, and it primarily is worst upon the youngest. Although people who get it as adults get very sick as well, too. But it essentially can incapacitate you. You know, you get fevers, your eyes can get infected. And, you know, when I talked to my grandmother about it, she had 2 brothers die of measles, you know, before there was antibiotics available to prevent the secondary complications of it. So, you know, as epidemics can happen, and you can get an epidemic of meningitis or something that changes with the seasons and affects a population of people and reaches a critical threshold where its transmission is perpetuated, accelerates. So when we looked at the curves and we saw, you know, from 2 to 5 to 15, it was clear that's what would happen. And in an unimmunized, non-immune population, it can just spread so quickly through it that you find yourself overwhelmed like we did.
And one of the places where you had to put your foot down was that standard practice before you had arrived there in this little clinic was that people with measles would be given antibiotics for their coughs and to sort of prevent secondary infection. And you had to wait. You had to teach your team members to wait until you knew that there was a secondary infection because there wasn't enough medicine to go around this way.
Yeah, it was a good lesson for me, actually. I mean, one of the principles of medicine in North America or in Western Europe, modern medicine, at least as I learned it, is that you treat the infection when you know there is one and when you know what it is. Ideally, you focus that tightly to prevent things like antibiotic resistance and things like that. You know, and so when I first arrived, everyone was getting amoxicillin, a very broad spectrum antibiotic, and I said, you know, we should stop that. And I learned, though, you know, within a week or two later, I saw enough cases of complications that I rescinded. I realized that, you know, as I pointed out to my team when I arrived, I had much more to learn about medicine in Sudan than I could teach. And so it certainly taught me a few lessons while I was there.
Childbirth is another thing that we know that it's dangerous when there's not adequate health care, but you saw some really heartbreaking cases. Can you talk a little bit about how babies are traditionally delivered and when people would bring a laboring woman to the hospital?
Yeah, it's, you know, since antiquity, humans have delivered their own babies, and so too in places like Sudan, the vast majority of them are handled by traditional midwives. And, you know, I could probably explain to you how to deliver a baby over the phone, because 95% of the time it's really, really easy. It's really straightforward. It's not,
if you're not the one doing it, but
right.
There,
yeah, okay. but the 5% of the time, or in places like Sudan, maybe more, because there's, you know, the mother perhaps isn't that well, or there's a tendency to have, you know, multiple pregnancies. Twins were common, at least where I was. So it can become a bit more tricky, and when, you know, a woman, the child gets stuck, or whether if the placenta does, or if there's a lot of bleeding in those minority of cases, there's very few resources. You know, the woman often dies. So So in Abyei, people would come from as far away as, you know, days away to with a woman who was sick in childbirth or because of it. And unfortunately, because of the distances they would have to travel, they would be very sick by the time that they arrived, either the baby or the mother. And, you know, if you look at what we often talk about in this type of work, disability-adjusted life years, or the amount of life contained in a patient that is lost because of disease or death, you really value women and children the most because they have such a resource to society, and it's such a tragic death, and in death, any death obviously is, but when a child or a young mother dies, even more so, it's affecting in a really profound way, and unfortunately all too common in places like Sudan.
There was also one, there was a little girl whose mother had died at the hospital not long before, really just an infant herself that everybody sort of took under their wing out of necessity, but also because people really loved her. Can you tell us a little bit about her?
Yeah, she was, you know, when I first arrived to the hospital, I was probably there for a week or so. And as the other doctor left, and I was on my own with all these patients, I was very overwhelmed, as you can imagine, and I got called to the hospital late one day to see an infant that had been brought in by a concerned neighbor. Her mother died in the hospital a few months before of malaria, and her father was a soldier, and essentially she was neglected. The neighbor found her in the grass, very dehydrated. I listened to her chest when I went to auscultate her chest. She tried to suck my stethoscope. She just was in need of water, so I gave her some, and she gained a kilogram in a day. And, you know, she was very tenuous, but she started to improve. And she was still feverish throughout that time. She didn't recover completely. And I remember I started to become fond of her. And it wasn't just because, you know, I worked with a lot of children at that point, or there were other children in the hospital, but there was something about this girl. She seemed heartbroken. You know, she was, you know, 7 or 8 months old. You'd look at her, she'd turn away, she never smiled, she never laughed. It seemed like she'd seen in her, you know, her few months of her life more and only heartbreak. And so I became fond of her. I started to fall in love with her a little bit. I couldn't help it. People ask me why, and I can't say whether it was because she was cuter than any other kid or not. It's just the way that it was. And I asked my field coordinator whether in any circumstances people have ever adopted a kid, because I didn't know what to do, you know, I didn't know how else to help her. And I was advised against it, probably, you know, wisely. And after about a month or so of trying to figure out what was wrong, I started her on TB treatment. And she went from being this, you know, kind of abandoned, orphaned, heartbroken, feverish girl to being a regular little one. And because of the nature of the treatment, she was in the hospital for 5 months with the rest of my mission. And I got to see her walk, and I got to see her talk. And as I look back in the book, you know, as I talk about it more, I realize the whole thing's about her. The whole book, from start to finish, is about that little girl. You know, if the unit of human understanding is the story, then that's how I make sense of Sudan, or my time in Abyei, and why it's worthwhile to continue to do this kind of work, you know, whether it makes a difference to the world in general. And I can't say that it does, or the history of you know, Sudan's future in towards peace or not. But I know it meant the world to that to her, to that little girl, as it did, and as it did to me.
I guess at some point you have to measure your effectiveness and your purpose according to one patient at a time, because if you take the whole range of people that you deal with and you watch so many die, that will just crush you.
Exactly. I mean, I think I feel very lucky that way, you know, or that's what I constantly try to remind myself, is that as a physician, my unit that I work in is the individual. And if you look at, you know, all these things that, particularly now, these days, these problems that seem so large, you know, whether it's the environment or conflict, and these large problems from, you know, the genesis, is the individual. And the best part about that is that so too the solutions are the same unit, one person at a time. And so when you're working in something, like I was in Abyei, and it's tough to know whether you're turning the tide or not, you just have to realize that it means the world to those people. And because of that, even in it's a small way, you really do change it one person at a time.
Have you been able, I know that ultimately a woman from the community was persuaded to take her in and sort of care for her along with her own children. Have you been able to keep up with her progress?
Well, no. What happened is the war came to Abyei, and after I'd left, everyone fled within the fighting, and I don't know what happened to her. It's one of my, you know, one of my constant regrets, I guess, is that I don't know. I'd love a chance to find out if I can make that possible. I'll do it. And there's been, people are still not populating Abyei right now, but once they do, I'll do my best to find out what happened to her.
Yeah, the whole, all the structures there at the time you were there have been burned.
Yes. Yeah. The fighting started as we anticipated that it might, and the people, all of my patients and everyone fled into the rain.
And the policy of MSF is that when there is an active war taking place, there are no staff members kept there.
Yeah, it's in some cases that's largely correct. Yeah, and mostly it's because of reasons of security, particularly now as a distinction between humanitarianism and military humanitarianism is blurring in the boundaries a bit more. Obviously, the priorities are given to the safety of the people who work for MSF. They take that very seriously. It's one of the reasons that makes me feel confident about going into places like I was in Sudan, and that they are, our well-being, our personal welfare is very much in the forefront of considerations. So you're right, in the active war, we tend to retreat to somewhere nearby where we can help civilians.
Dr. James Miskolic is my guest. His new book is called 6 Months in Sudan, A Young Doctor in a War-Torn Village. We'll be back to our conversation in a moment and invite you to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Dr. James Miskolic. His new book is called 6 Months in Sudan, A Young Doctor in a War-Torn Village. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we find Libby in Dallas. Hello, Libby.
Hi. Dr. Miskolic, I have a question about the nature of the conflict now. I have a friend who was with MSF in Sudan, of course, is no longer there. In her opinion, this is no longer really a genocide. It's a tribal warfare. What do you say about that?
Yeah, it's a difficult question. I know it's something that's been talked a lot about in the media and as well by politicians in the United States and Canada. And I think that at some point the answer happens to be it's a fine point of distinction whose ultimate answer perhaps doesn't really matter. What is true is probably that tensions between different peoples, ethnicity is slightly different, or tribe, or language, or belief system, perhaps has a complicating factor. But what is true is that so many people there are suffering unnecessarily from a lack of both resources and an opportunity to participate in decisions that are affecting their welfare, whether it's casting a vote or having access to some of the resources that by being a citizen in Sudan one would naturally think is one of the privileges. of it. I think that too often there can be a discussion, a dialogue about which it is, and from my perspective, that's just it's trying to put a fine point on it. But I think what the real answer is, those people need our assistance as much as we're able to give it.
An email from Hank in Dallas asks whether you had any problems psychologically readjusting to practicing medicine in the West with all the accompanying resources available here.
I never really had any feeling except the greatest relief about having the chance to do the job that I was trained to do. I think only once did I say to someone, as a month or so after I came back, did I say to someone, do you know where I've been? You know, do you know how lucky you are? Because the truth is, people don't, you know, and I knew that. But they don't really know what it's like to have had a floor full of children who are, you know, starving with measles and feeling the responsibility. They don't know. And so I never really had, you know, my difficulty wasn't really in practicing medicine. It was that urgency that lives within you when you come back off the plane, standing in Geneva or Toronto, and having just left that same feeding center floor and thinking, well, what am I supposed to do now? Just go see a movie? You know, how do I fit back in? And after a few months, of course, the urgency fades and you start to find pleasure in the things that you left behind. And with time, I think it fits a bit better.
You make a point in the book of thanking your friends for not immediately asking you to tell them all about what had happened and not asking how the book was coming along. Did people sort of sense that you required some time to process this before you'd be ready to tell your stories?
I think that, you know, yeah, my good friends did. I think my good friends knew that it's something that I didn't really have the words to talk about, and I would bring it up when I did. And it's perhaps, I don't know if it's unique to me, but it's the way that I end up dealing with things is I tend to, you know, hold them in until there's a moment where I feel like I have the resources to address them. So I think probably any author can empathize with people saying, so how's the book going?
Yeah, shut up, I'm working on it.
It's going terrible. I don't want to talk about it. So I think that's how you know the people who really are your good friends.
You did undertake this thing with the understanding that you would blog about it the entire time. What sorts of requirements did MSF set up for you as you were doing this all along?
Well, I had to send my posts through security clearance in Amsterdam, in Geneva, as well as in Canada. So to make sure that, you know, I didn't come out as being for or against one particular side, because of course that's one of the principles of humanitarianism is independence and neutrality. So by being neutral, by not declaring an affiliation with one person or another, one side or another, we're given an opportunity to work this humanitarian space. And so I think that I had that very much in my mind when I was writing the story. I wanted to write a story about the poverty of medicine and allow just that to kind of speak to the greater, you know, political tableau. I didn't really want to jeopardize our position of being close to the population because I felt the need to have my own personal point enunciated. You know, I was finishing the draft of my book, and I sent it through MSF as well, too, not because they ever had any, you know, made any efforts to censor me, but just because I wanted to be careful. And in one of the scenes, there's a scene where a woman is raped, and I have to, it's, you know, she's before I, she asks, she comes to me and asks for help. And I had to be very careful about that scene because there was talk about using, you know, contraceptives and the morning after pill and things like that. But I wanted to be sure that we are on safe ground in a place like Sudan, a very devoutly Muslim country, where I could write about it, because even though it is the truth, and it was very important for me to tell the story about how women suffer so disproportionately there sometimes because of their lack of options, even more than that, I didn't want to decrease the chance of the next woman who had a similar problem coming to the hospital and not able to get the medicine she needs because I wanted to tell the truth. So luckily we found out that it was in conditions of medical necessity. It was legal, and so, but I think that we had it come from, both MSF and myself had come from the very same spirit of trying to offer assistance and tell a story where it serves the truth.
And as in other parts of the world where there isn't access to safe medical abortion, women try to take matters into their own hands many times.
Yeah, of course, such a stigmatized part that people have a tough time even having a dialogue about it in too many places. But you're seeing slow bits of change. I think as there's gets to be a growing awareness, I think that we're slowly starting to see that change in countries where it wasn't an option before.
When you came back to the West, you were struck by the squareness of everything. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, it's interesting. There's, the rules, not just the rules and the houses and the roads. The point between A and B is a straight line. I could measure my route out today with a ruler. When we're working in a rural area in Sudan or in Cambodia, it was much more contours. It was not something that was, in some ways, natural. I know that's such a cliche to talk about, this idyllic or very return to nature that people describe in Africa or in rural Asia, but it's not untrue. I think that you're struck by the difference, how rigid and organized and sterile sometimes the life that we've created for ourselves. We distanced ourselves so very much from the ground in many ways. So you feel that, you see that contrast very acutely when you return.
There's also a really beautiful scene in the book where you talk about a mother whose child wasn't really able to drink or didn't want to drink, and the mother would sort of sit there for a long time at a time trying to get her child to drink. Can you talk about that very simple act and what that sort of communicated to you?
Yeah, it was very beautiful. I with such patience and dedication and such an act of love, that it was inspirational in a way. The context was I was walking through the measles recubra, that long hut that we built to accommodate all those people, and I had a child in my arms because his mom had measles, and she was too sick to feed him or take care of him anymore. And so I was walking around the recubra trying to see if any of the mothers would take him. And in the midst of this scene, seeing these people care for their own children so delicately, no one would take care of this little boy. And I just thought that, that's the hard truth of nature, so beautiful. But in when there's a chance between offering your child the care that he or she needs and taking someone else's on, it's no contest, I guess.
And another thing that really speaks to the harshness of life there, and by necessity, again, you tell a story about an 8-year-old girl who had tuberculosis, that the first time she was brought in for treatment, her parents came with her. And then after that, every time she came for her dose of meds, whether it was every few days or every week, she would come by herself.
Mm. Yeah, I think one of my favorite parts of the mission for me was that part with tuberculosis, to see patients who... There's such stigma towards that disease and probably chronic diseases in general everywhere, but the people who reluctantly would show up with tuberculosis because they heard that there was treatment, and then after they started to get better, became such proud advocates, became such, so empowered, and it was inspiring. And this little girl who was 8 and so brave, I'd have to cut the pills and explain to her, again, how to take them, and this one and a half, once a day, and this one a day, and it made up my week. I looked forward to those 4 hours on Thursday afternoon where I got a chance to have an office full of those people.
Is there anything that you experienced, even recognizing the value of having been there and done this work and hoping to go back again, is there anything that you wish that you could purge from your mind?
I think that I mean, if I could, you know, I wouldn't change any experience in my life that I've lived. I think, you know, among them, not just in Sudan and otherwise, there have been hard ones, but they've all made me who I am, and as such, I don't think that I would erase any of them. I think if I could do it again differently, there's things I would change, and the next time I do this again, I think it would be, I took everything so seriously, and I took very little respite. I found very little space for laughter. You know, I took this, I wrote when I was, there was times when there was a break in the hospital, and I think the next time, I think I'm going to join a soccer team or whatever, or learn Arabic or Dinka, and maybe work my way to try to get into a wedding or something like that. Not my own, but as a guest. And, you know, I think I learned some lessons about how to live, I think.
You're teaching medical students now as part of your job. How do you begin to communicate this to the ones who have not yet had much life experience under their belts and are very earnest and want to do the right thing but really can't relate to what you're trying to tell them?
Yeah, I think that, you know, there's a lot to learn in medical school. I remember a month or two ago, I was working with a student and I saw a woman who came into the emergency department and I could tell right away she was going to die. Learned that skill very early on in emergency medicine. But it was her wish. She was confined to, you know, her bed. She had a stroke, and it was her wish to die. So I was working with a student, and I said to him, I want you to go be in that room, and I want you to be there when she dies. Because not only did I want him to see the changes that happen in the human body, how the breathing, you know, speeds up, the heart speeds up, and then eventually slows down and stops. But I wanted them to see that the difference between, you know, that 1 second when there's life there and when it's gone, and how the machinery is still all there, the exact same constituents in the same cells, but then it's that thing that is life, it's gone. And from that, you know, that's where you're there to care for as a doctor. And if people feel a responsibility that extends beyond these, you know, imaginary lines that we've drawn in the ground because of history and because of resources, and I think that that's something that falls to us as a responsibility, as society puts it on us. If people think that what's happening in places like Sudan or people are suffering unnecessarily, with that recognition too goes some responsibility. And so, you know, we get the students who are interested and some who aren't, and it's my job to teach them medicine as best as I can, no matter who they are.
Dr. James Miskolic is Assistant Professor of Medicine at the University of Toronto and a founding editor of the journal Open Medicine. His new book is called 6 Months in Sudan, A Young Doctor in a War-Torn Village. James, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
My pleasure.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.